Co-host, yeah.
All right, so for our last year, I think I can actually finish up both topics that I wanted to do, not just CPAP. I think I can also get through prosthetic arms. So let's try. I'm gonna aim to do both today. I think we can do it. So from last week, even though it wasn't strictly about medical devices, though we did get to talk about taking temperature and those sort of things, what we really were trying to establish was the background for these next two shiurim. For these next two topics, which is that there is this concept called biological maisa, right? Doing action by with your body, and that there's a difference between, for example, when I physically go ahead and cook something with my hands versus when my body, emits a certain amount of heat, and that is might be more difficult to call it a maisa. That idea was originally established by Rav Vosner. Rav Bleich also expanded on it and utilized that same idea. I would like to point out, just going back to one of the points I made last week, about I framed Rav Bleich and Rav Moshe as arguing with each other about taking blood pressure on Shabbos, that they would disagree, because Rav Moshe says that the reason why I'm allowed to take my temperature on Shabbos is because that's not considered measuring on Shabbos. It's not, so if it's not considered, it's not a melacha at all. It's nothing at all to do with the lametas melacha, so it's not a problem. Whereas Reb Leich would argue, based on what we saw from him, the argument should be that the reason why I'm allowed to take my temperature on Shabbos is because I'm just checking the heat. It's the heat of my body is making the thermometer move. That's not, I can't call that a melacha on Shabbos. So based on those different svaras, I wanted to argue that taking your blood pressure on Shabbos, obviously, if it's for pikuach nefesh, then obviously it's allowed. but if it's someone else, if it's let's say, as my example was that came up with us, was med students wanted to practice with each other on Shabbos, so then it's not as obvious that you would be able to check blood pressure, because according to Rav Moshe, I would argue that measuring the blood, just like checking your temperature, is not considered measuring as one of the lametas melachos. Similarly, checking your blood pressure is not considered measuring, so there would be nothing wrong. According to Reb Leich's argument, that measuring is a measuring your temperature is a passive. It's your body's emitting heat, and that's what you're checking. That's not considered a problem. But according to Reb Leich, you're actually checking something by blood pressure, because you're strapping the cuff around. You're applying the pressure, and that's how the pressure is being measured. So according to Reb Leich, it might not be allowed. So I just wanted to point out that I'm making all these suggestions. Neither Reb Moshe or Reb Leich actually wrote this down anywhere. For all I know, if I would just frame the question to Reb Moshe as, is practicing taking blood pressure on Shabbos a problem, maybe you would say it is a problem. Maybe you'd say you're actually doing some sort of maisa. Maybe he really does agree with Reb Leich. He just wasn't framing it in that way. He just, as soon as you asked him about checking temperature on Shabbos, he said, "What are you bothering me for? It's not even one of the lametas melachos. It's not even something I want to consider." For all I know, he would agree. Maybe disagrees. I have absolutely no idea. But I didn't want to make it sound like it was they were necessarily arguing. I was just I just wanted to demonstrate that's only what I was implying from their positions. So this week we're moving on to actually discussing sleep apnea and those different devices. So first of all, let's discuss what sleep apnea is. So sleep apnea, the way it classically presents, is a patient is just always tired. He gets full night's sleep. He's napping during the day. He can't figure out. He's always tired, right? So what happens is these patients, due to sleep apnea, basically while they're sleeping, they stop breathing during the night. They wake up, catch their breath, so to speak. Continue breathing and then go back to sleep. They wake up for such a short period of time, they don't remember that they actually woke up. They just wake up for long enough to be able to breathe again. And they have episodes like that throughout the night. Usually, they're one of the classic questions is you ask their partner if they're snoring a lot. So these patients, they need treatment for that. The reason why is A, other than the fact that obviously they're tired and they need to sleep, there are also a lot of complications. Complications including obviously, daytime fatigue, they're tired during the day. This also could cause hypertension. It can cause arrhythmias, sudden cardiac death, type 2 diabetes, stroke, a lot of other things. Basically, it's not good. and we want to treat it and want to be able to take care of them. So before actually treating them, the first thing we have to do is actually diagnose that this is actually what they have. So the most specific and sensitive way to do it, it was something called nocturnal polysomnography. Basically, you're hospitalized overnight, and we check your vitals, your brain activity, breathing patterns, your arm and leg movement, your blood oxygen levels. They take a lot of measurements in the hospital, and that's how they get as full of a picture as possible. Obviously, this entails actually sleeping in the hospital overnight. That's, you know, not the most comfortable thing in the world. So there are also home sleep tests available, you know, where you could just do this all at home. And hook yourself up to the machine, it records it, and then you give it back to your doctor. So the question is, can I do this on Shabbos? Now, you know, while we'll discuss whether or not everything else here, the treatment has to have, maybe has some sort of level of pikuach nefesh, it's hard to argue that the diagnosis has a level of pikuach nefesh. I have a hard time believing that if you're diagnosed with, you know, sleep apnea a day or two later, if that would really make that much of a difference. So let's assume that this has, you know, for this definitely not pikuach nefesh, and whatever you want, you got the test on Friday, so you wanted to do it Friday night, or you got an appointment in a sleep lab. The only time that was available wasn't Shabbos, so you wanted to go in on Shabbos or whatever on Friday night to sleep there overnight. So can you do this on Shabbos? Now, I couldn't find any sources, anybody discussing this at all. But what I do have is I have people discussing whether or not you're allowed to do an EKG on Shabbos. Now, problem with that is that most people that are discussing EKGs on Shabbos aren't really talking about it in terms of the patient. In general, we're assuming that if you're putting an EKG on somebody on Shabbos, they're all assuming it's pikuach nefesh, right? Someone shows up with chest pain to the ER, you're going to put an EKG on them. There are a lot of times you do EKGs, which is not pikuach nefesh, right? If it's pre-op for a surgery, you just want an EKG on somebody, that's not pikuach nefesh. So I didn't find any sources discussing that scenario. I think they would assume that you shouldn't be doing it on Shabbos because of the other melachas that can be involved. You have to plug in the EKG machine and all these other things. But arguably, if I was able to avoid all those issues, and same thing with diagnosing sleep apnea, if I can avoid all those issues, I put on a Shabbos clock or something like that, then we have what to discuss, right? So by sleep apnea, the home sleep test, where our theoretical ilchus Shabbos problem is that there's information being recorded. By an EKG, it's a little bit easier. I don't actually know what a home sleep test looks like, but I assume it's all electronic and it's all digital. So then you would have to argue that writing on a computer, typing on a computer is a ksiva or some sort of writing. On an EKG, it's probably a little bit easier because EKGs, a lot of them just have a strip of paper. So you're actually writing on a piece of paper. You'd also have to argue, this is off topic, but just to a couple of all the things you'd have to argue in order to make this usher on Shabbos is you would also have to argue that those little, the strips of the EKG, right? It's just the QRS waves, is considered writing because it's something that's significant, even though it's not actually letters, right? It's just like lines. So I could potentially argue that's not considered writing at all. But let's assume chumra for everything. We're going to be machmer in every single thing we possibly can be. We'll assume that there's iser for that's considered ksiva. We'll assume writing on a computer if it's digital that's also considered ksiva. We'll be as machmer as possible. Still, going back to our what we've established from last week, the question remains: is this considered something that would be iser on Shabbos? Because I'm not actually doing a ma'aseh here, right? By an EKG, it's my heart beating. I'm literally not doing anything. There's nothing I could be doing. I could change here. Maybe by the sleep apnea, by the home sleep test, maybe if I'm moving a lot or something like that, maybe that will change what the monitor is reading, but still these are involuntary actions. Also, if not just EKGs, I forgot to mention, but also if for people that more practical scenario is for a Holter, people that have to be put on a Holter, right? Sometimes it's for a while, it can be over Shabbos as well. So again, you have, most likely you're assuming it's pikuach nefesh anyway. Well, just to say, for whatever reason, you can do it 6 days. You don't have to do it over Shabbos, or for whatever reason, you can skip Shabbos, and it won't be pikuach nefesh, right? So then, maybe is that considered a problem wearing it on Shabbos? So the only real source I have the Nishmas of Ram, and he's talking about a Holter, putting a Holter on over Shabbos, and he says you shouldn't do it over Shabbos if you can avoid it. Although he does quote like, he says it's not allowed, and then next in the line, he quotes Rosh Lema Zalman that says, well, the information is not really retained for anything, so it's not really all that, it's not important information. That's one of the rules for writing on Shabbos. It has to be something that's significant that you're actually going to keep. since this is information they're anyway throwing out, you don't actually keep it for anything, maybe it's not a problem. But if we go back to our argument from last week, none of this is relevant, right? As long as I avoided every other issue, the issues of actually plugging it in, then not any other melacha that comes up afterwards is irrelevant, because the writing of the EKG, the actual the sleep test, monitoring my heart rate, my breathing patterns, et cetera, all these things are caused by something which is not a maisa. It's my, you know, my body functioning. That's not considered a maisa, at least according to what we established last week. For other people, if they, even within their argument, if you want to argue it's a maisa, maybe you could still make the case that you would be allowed to use them, because they would argue that maybe it's some sort of grumma. They would say that, you know, it's whatever. You don't intend for it to happen. And even if you do intend for it to happen, maybe, again, we said you have to be machmir and all the ksiva things in order to make this usher. So maybe if it's a computer, it's not really considered ksiva. Maybe if it's the EKG, it's just some random lines in a piece of paper. That's not either considered ksiva. So maybe they'll allow it also. But, you know, if you are want to be machmir in all these cases, and someone, let's say it is pikuach nefesh, someone does have to put it on Shabbos, then maybe they shouldn't be allowed to move around. Because when you move around, you're causing... if you have the sleep test, you're causing it to the sleep test on you. You're causing the breathing. Your breathing pattern probably changes. Or if you have a Holter on you, your heart rate might go up if you're walking quickly. So maybe you should have to stay at home, right? Not so that you don't cause anything to change. So even within their argument of, you know, saying it's some sort of grumma, you could still potentially, I don't think they would actually make this case, but you could still potentially argue that it would be prohibited to do anything extra on Shabbos to have the monitor record any new movement. But if you assume the other way, that's all biological, you know, function, that's not considered a maisa at all, then you wouldn't have any problem. That's all within diagnosing sleep apnea. Now let's talk about treating sleep apnea. So as far as I know, there are four different devices, at least that I found, so that's what I'm going to talk about. The most basic, the oldest one, is a CPAP, which is continuous positive airway pressure. Basically what ends up happening is you just, the problem with sleep apnea is that your airways are collapsed because there's not enough pressure to keep them open. So what it does is a CPAP basically just provides that pressure to make sure that the airway remains open. They are very loud, they're very uncomfortable, they're very annoying, and people hate them. So there are a lot of newer devices that are more comfortable for patients, so that people will actually use these things. Because again, we're trying to avoid all these complications while maintaining a certain quality of life. Right, the CPAP, part of the problem with CPAP is our issue with sleep apnea, the biggest issue, the presenting problem, is usually the patient complains that he's tired the next day, even though he slept. With the CPAP, they didn't sleep and they're also tired the next day, so you haven't really accomplished anything. So whatever, so there's other devices. So there's a BPAP, but apparently BPAP is the company. BiPAP is what the actual type of machine is. It's a bi-level positive airway pressure, which basically means... they have a preset inspiratory and expiratory airway pressure. So when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out, you need different pressures in order to maintain a patent airway. So the idea is that when you breathe out, it increases the pressure. When you're breathing in, it will increase the pressure. When you're breathing out, it will decrease. Okay. So that's, again, responding to how you breathe. There's an auto titrating positive airway pressure, which that changes the level of airway pressure in response to airflow. It's more advanced. It also takes into account circuit pressure and snoring. It responds to more things. There's an adaptive servo-ventilation, which that responds to patients' breathing patterns to ensure that the patient always remains within 90% of their oxygen needs. So within these four, now again, if we're assuming that this is pikuach nefesh, right, we'd have to argue that, again, all the complications that I mentioned before, those are all things that would allow me to say that treating sleep apnea is pikuach nefesh. Now, I'm not sure about two things. One is, I was actually just texting with a pulmonologist. I think he sent me another text, but I forgot. I didn't get a chance to read it before I started speaking. So for all I know that he told me I'm wrong about what I'm about to say. But there are two things. One is that, when do you need a treatment every night? Meaning, is 6 out of 7 enough to maintain to prevent these complications from occurring? That's one. that's one option. One thing to consider. If it is, then it's not pikuach nefesh if we don't use it one night a week. And then there, you know, you could make the case that you would then have to debate whether or not you should be using it on that one night. Remember, in addition to the Bikuach Nefesh problems, there's also just, you know, comfort of life problems. The patient every Shabbos is going to be exhausted. He wouldn't have slept well. It's just not a comfortable experience. So you'd have to argue, you'd argue not within Bikuach Nefesh, but within maybe let's call it a Chayla Shein B'Sakana. Maybe it's a little bit less than that. We'd have to contemplate what category that patient would be. The other thing is, at least this was a different pulmonologist had told me. I'm not sure how accurate it is, though, but he told me that apparently people get prescribed these things all the time when not necessarily, and it's not necessarily indicated. Like sometimes, you know, they just get it because their health insurance pays for it for free. They're getting it anyway. So they just give it to them to make them feel better, but the patients don't actually need it. So they don't use it every night anyway. So forget whether or not it's indicated and it helps with Bikuach Nefesh. These patients don't even need it. You know, they sometimes use it, sometimes don't. So maybe they shouldn't be using it on Shabbos. But that case is probably not even a comfort situation. That's just whatever. You know, sometimes they feel like they're in the mood of getting some extra oxygen while they sleep, so they put it on. I don't really know how to categorize them. But then also we'd have to, you know, it's even a lower level. We can again debate, you know, can you turn this thing on Shabbos? Can you use this thing on Shabbos? Just to clarify, we're not talking about turning it on Shabbos. I misspoke, right? Turning it on, we're assuming you're using a Shabbos clock or whatever it is. And this way we can avoid that issue. Let's avoid, you know, we'll focus specifically on what we care about and just avoid all the other problems that could potentially come up. So as far as these machines, I think we have three different categories. So for a CPAP, that's, again, the continuous pressure, respective of what you're doing. I think that, you know, that should be allowed according to everybody because nothing that you're doing changes what the machine's doing. The machine is just applying a certain amount of positive pressure. It's going to do that irrespective of your input. It's a very basic machine. So who cares? As long as it's turned on in a normal way, who cares what you do? And it should be totally fine. The auto titrating positive pressure and the BiPAP, those both respond to a patient's respiratory pattern. So that maybe would depend, again, on the same thing we established last week, since it depends on how you're breathing. So we'll have to question whether or not the way that you're breathing is your breathing patterns, is that considered a Maisa and Shabbos or not? According to everybody else in the world, it's potentially a Maisa and Shabbos, in which case, because the machine is responding, that could be considered a Malacha. And it'll be also to use them on Shabbos if it's not Bikuach Nefesh. According to Reb Bleich and potentially Reb Osner, since it's biological function, right? I don't control how I breathe. It's involuntary. That's not considered a Maisa. Who cares if because of my breathing patterns, the machine ends up responding to me different ways? The last machine that we talked about, that was the adaptive servo ventilation machine. That responds when it senses that the patient stops breathing, it provides more pressure. So I would argue that not only according to Reb Bleich and Reb Osner, but even according to everybody else, everybody would agree it's allowed to be used because the reason the machine turns on when you stop breathing, it's not my breathing that's causing the machine to go on. It's my lack of breathing. It's my lack of Maisa. It's my lack of action that's causing the machine to function. And my lack of action, even if I don't want to argue that that biological function is not considered a Maisa and a Lacha, my lack of action is what's causing a machine to go, to function. I don't think that would be considered a problem. So that is, what I want to discuss about these devices. The next section we could talk about, I want to talk about the prosthetic hands and how we want to think about that, which is basically up until this category right here, we're really discussing biological Maisa, right? This is whether or not we're considering my voluntary biological functions as a Maisa and Shabbos. And this next category is going to be whether or not we can consider actions that are done with thought as a Maisa and Shabbos. So before we continue, this is that I just want to take a break and just if anyone has any questions, input, I would love to hear it. This is the first time I'm presenting this, so I'd love to hear what everybody's thoughts are.
Hi, one of my friends, may rest in peace, was the first person I knew who got diagnosed and needed the machine. Normally you go for a fitting, you go for a test the first night, and then if they diagnose you with sleep apnea, you come back another time for a fitting to figure out how to adjust the machine. His case was so bad, just to take an example that it can be, like, they felt it was life-threatening. They said, we're going to diagnose it right now. You have to go home with the machine. We can't let you go home without it, rather than come back for a second time to fit. Now, in my case, I couldn't stand being in the sleep room and trying to and be wired up. And they said, well, you're not going to come back again. I said, I'm not coming back again. I can't take this room. So that's when they were looking for a CPAP at the time. That's when they decided to go with the APAP. I said, all right, we'll give you the APAP for a month. It'll record you, and we'll know how to fit you after that. So they use it as a fitting device. But I did want to mention one other device that you may want to, at some future time, bring up, which is the Apple Watch. Now, the Apple Watch is can continually monitor all kinds of things when you're sleeping. It might even wake you up for certain reasons, but certainly the next morning you can then download on your iPhone all kinds of sleeping information, what happened all night long. So that's another device that you could wear. You don't have to do anything, you just wear it, but it's recording the whole time.
So thanks for bringing that up. I have everything prepared for that. I just didn't want to mention here because it was really a medical device. I figured I'd focus on medical devices and not on the smartwatches. But if you want, I could send you all that afterwards. If you share your email, pleasure to send you the different people. A lot of people have spoken about it because people like Apple Watches. So this, at least I'm telling you something new that I don't think other people have discussed. Apple Watches, I have a lot of people that discuss them. I'll send you everyone's thoughts. But I agree with you that the principle would be the same, meaning in order to make an Apple Watch something that's usher to wear on Shabbos, leaving aside that depends which watch you have, right? Sometimes it'll turn on if you move your hand. So that would be potentially be a ma'isa. But if you leaving aside that issue and you're just talking about the fact that it's recording everything that you're doing, that might not be considered a problem. Again, for all the reasons that we just said here. One is if you're in the world of biological action is not considered a ma'isa, then easy, right? It's not considered a problem. If you're in the Rosh Lema Zalman world, which we discussed before, it might not either be a problem because these things are just like recorded in a cloud somewhere. It's not real ksiva, it's not real recording. It doesn't really matter. A lot of people disagree with that. They think, just because it's recorded in a cloud somewhere, I can retrieve that data. I do care about that data. So maybe it is actually considered something that's significant. But that's in the two sentences, three sentences, the watches thing. But I'd be happy to send you what I have on it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. All right, moving on. Okay. So the next part here is prosthetic arms. So the idea of prosthetic arms, they're really working on this technology, right? So we're a little bit of science fiction right now, everything here is not completely developed yet. But basically the idea is the problem with arms that people, like a primitive arm is that even if you could figure out how to get it to somehow hook it up to the muscle so it can respond, the trick is that whenever you do anything with your hand also feels, what it's touching. It needs to also get sensory feedback. It has to get both. It's not just the muscular movement. It has to have, the nerves have to go both ways, right? Both the afferent nerves and the efferent nerves have to functioning in order to get both of the sensory information and the motor information in order to have a hand that can actually replicate a biological hand, a organic hand. So we have some interesting sources to try to prove how we want to think about Maisa, about action by thought. So Moshe Rabbeinu, back in the desert, when we were traveling around, we used to get man every day. That's how we ate, right? On Friday, the first time around, Moshe told them, don't go looking for man on Shabbos. Right, on Friday you're going to be getting a double serving of man, and that should last you for the 2 days. The Mechilta over there explains that Moshe wasn't just telling the Jews don't go looking for the man; he was also telling them do not prepare the man for Shabbos. Any food that you want to eat on Shabbos, you have to prepare on Friday. Now this is fascinating because classically, how was the man prepared? This is a little bit debatable. Basically, I decided what I wanted it to taste like, and that's what it tasted like. You decided what you want. We can both eat the same, whatever it was, and we each decide what we wanted it to taste like, and that's what it would taste like. So the Moshe of Zekenim, which is the Baalei Tosfos, Pirushan Chumash, he says that the way I got the mud to taste the way I wanted it to taste was I said out loud, tonight I want to eat, you know, I don't know, steak. So then my mud tasted like steak. So once you have the Moshe of Zekenim, this becomes completely irrelevant and not particularly interesting for us, because as we discussed there's a debate whether or not speaking is considered a ma'isa. If you argue that maybe the Moshe of Zekenim thinks that speaking is considered a ma'isa, it's considered an action, so then that's not really helpful for us. But what is helpful is that the Mechilta thinks that you didn't have to verbally say anything. You would just think, you have a happy thought. You think about steak and your mud tasted like steak. In which case, if the Mechilta tells me that I have to have my thoughts about what I want to eat Shabbos day on Friday, that means my thought is something that caused food to be prepared. And therefore, my thought, and if that's usher, that means my thought can be considered a ma'isa, can be considered an action. However, I would like to backtrack that comment just at least a little bit, because what they're telling me is that thinking is good enough to be considered a ma'isa for tikkun mana. Tikkun mana is like fixing up food. And that's a lower threshold of ma'isa, of action, than actually, you know, cooking something or actually, I don't know, cutting down a tree. It's potentially a lower threshold. So it's not necessarily clear that thinking would be considered, that this is a good source, that thinking can be considered a ma'isa, but it's, you know, potentially alluding to that. The most significant nafkaminas with at least a hand is whether or not that's good enough for considering shaking lulav, right? In order to shake lulav, you have to have an action of shaking the lulav. There's a whole nother debate, which we're not going to talk about now, but by lulav, it's not clear how you shake the lulav. You shake the lulav with your hand. You potentially can also shake your lulav with something else. If, let's say, I'm holding onto something, which I then use to shake the lulav, that might also work. Or maybe if I shake the lulav with my mouth, that might also work. This is a debate. We'll leave aside the question of whether or not a prosthetic arm can actually be considered a arm in halacha for those purposes. But the current issue is whether or not that prosthetic arm shaking the lulav would be considered a ma'isa, right? So maybe according to this mechilta, it can be. Or maybe they're giving me the case that it's tikkun mana. And tikkun mana, you know, doesn't have the same threshold for an actual ma'isa. I need to have, you know, more input. Rav Asha Weiss seems to think that using this robotic arm is some sort of grama. It's quoted by his Talmud, Rabbi Sprung, in one of his, he has this Chumash thing that comes out. He has a parsha sheet every week where he discusses different medical issues. So one of them, he argued that, he quoted Rav Asha Weiss that this robotic arm would be considered some sort of grama. I don't really know what to do with that, because I don't understand the problem is. Let's say moving the arm is some sort of grama, right? That means that in order to cook something, I have to move the arm and then cooking something. So it's a grama on potentially another, it's two steps removed. I'm not so convinced, but maybe, I mean, that's, you know, I'm not, it's also be like, since, you know, the data here isn't really clear on how it works yet, because I don't think we have really, you know, working prototypes that people are actually using on a regular basis. So maybe, you know, just in theory, he's saying it could be some sort of grama. Once we actually have a real prototype to discuss, and once people are actually using this, then, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit of a more nuanced response. There's a Dr. Birnbaumer, apparently, that I found, that apparently he's using, this is again in paralyzed patients. We're trying to communicate with our paralyzed patients. So he, instead of, in general, the way these things work is, right, we mentioned last time for locked-in syndrome, they can follow track the eye movement. So he wanted to use variations in blood flow to determine if a patient is thinking yes or no, right? So if you're thinking yes, blood moves to one part of your brain. If you're thinking no, blood moves to another part of your brain. I might argue, and again, I have no sources for this whatsoever. I'm making things up as we go along in this year. But I might argue that that's different than thinking. Maybe thinking, you know, again, if I want to get all biological about it, thinking involves, you know, neurons stimulating one another, and that would potentially be considered a ma'isa. But blood flow, I don't know, that's not really a ma'isa. It's just, you know, blood moving from one part of your body to the other. It's, you know, I'm not as impressed. So then maybe that's not considered a ma'isa. And then according to everybody, that wouldn't be a problem at all to use that. There's another, the the last device, you know, new device that I'd like to discuss here is there's this whole group of technology. It's called brain computer interface. The idea is that, you know, you hook up things to the brain and you can actually cause things to happen from that. The idea here is that this appeared in an article in Nature, so it's apparently important. But the idea was that they were able to write things down on a computer based on this device. It was, you know, it's attached to the brain. Whatever you're thinking, it writes it down for you. So, you know, you're able to think thoughts that are then written down. So the question is that considered, is that be something that's allowed on Shabbos? So we have somewhat of an interesting sugya to think about in regards to this. Moshe Rabbeinu, on the last day of his life, he writes Sefer Torah for every single one of the Shvatim. Now, the problem is, if he's writing a Sefer Torah for all the Shvatim on the last day of his life, is that he also died on Shabbos, which would mean Moshe Rabbeinu wrote Sefer Torah on Shabbos. Now, it's probably safe to assume that Moshe Rabbeinu kept Shabbos, so it's a little bit weird, and you know what exactly is going on. This is a whole sugya of what exactly is happening. And there's a lot of good sugyas with how Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the end of the Sefer Torah. This also says Moshe Rabbeinu died. So how can Moshe Rabbeinu have written that he died? You know, because if he's alive, he can't write that he died. So maybe he should. There's a lot of good, you know, interesting sugyas that aren't really relevant so much halacha lemaisa, but just fascinating about the end of the Sefer Torah and Sefer Torah in general. So there is this at least one of the answers. There's something called Hashavas HaKulamis. Now, whatever that is, I'm giving you a name, and then we'll try to define that later. But whatever that is, that apparently made it okay for Moshe Rabbeinu to write the Sefer Torah on Shabbos. Now, I have no idea what it is, but I'll give you one of two options. Either Hashavas HaKulamis is an act of writing, in which case Moshe Rabbeinu wrote on Shabbos, but at least I have a kosher Sefer Torah. If it's not considered an act of writing, then Moshe Rabbeinu might not have written on Shabbos, but it's not kosher to make a Sefer Torah. Meaning, whatever excuse I want to give, whatever answer I want to give to somehow make sense for how Moshe Rabbeinu was able to write a Sefer Torah, something has to give. I can't get both. Either I'm not writing, in which case I'm good for, as far as Shabbos, I'm good, but as far as reading a Sefer Torah, I'm missing something. In order to write a Sefer Torah, you have to write something. That's one of the rules. That's one of the halachas of writing Sefer Torah. On the other hand, right, if I manage to write a Sefer Torah, if I didn't do Ksiva on Shabbos, if I'm not actually doing writing on Shabbos, then I don't have a kosher Sefer Torah. One way or the other, I'm losing something here. I'm not accomplishing something. The Pnei Yeshua has this interesting idea, and he wants to make the case that Maaser for Shabbos, that action on Shabbos, is on a higher threshold than in other areas of Halacha. Meaning when we talk about Maaser, when we talk about action, there's not just one type. There are a couple of different types. He makes that case very simply. On Shabbos, I have an isser of Amir La'akum on Shabbos. Right? I'm not allowed to tell a guy to do something for me that will be aser for me to do on Shabbos. The Bnei Yeshua asks, why do I need Amir La'akum for? Why can't I just be shlichus? Anytime I tell someone else to do a ma'isa for me, right? I'd be responsible for that. Assuming you would have to assume that shlichus by a guy would be attributed to me. But assuming that, then you can end up being chayiv for that reason. Why do I need a separate isser of Amir La'akum? So he explains that on Shabbos, shlichus wouldn't be enough to say that it's something that's usher for me. Because on Shabbos, we have a high threshold of what is considered ma'isa. We have a very high threshold. It has to be something that I'm actually physically doing myself. So if I am making a shliach, I'm telling somebody else to do it, and it's a guy, so he's not responsible for, you know, for him, it's fine. So then it doesn't matter that I told him to do it because I didn't actually do any melacha on Shabbos. Someone else did it. A guy did it. It's irrelevant. So therefore, the Torah had to introduce this new idea. True, there's a ma'isa on Shabbos has this high threshold, and true, it has to be something you do yourself. But we have this special halacha. We want to make sure that, you know, Shabbos stays in its pure form. So you can't go around telling guy to do all melachas for you on Shabbos. Otherwise, you know, we sort of ruin our day of rest. So Rav Kalbach, who has this great set on Chumash, really interesting stuff in his parish on Chumash, he makes the case that the same thing applies for, the same idea could be applied for the Sefer Torah. Meaning that for Shabbos, in order to be something to be Shabbat HaKulamis, is not considered a Maisa. It's not high enough level to be considered a Maisa. But by Sefer Torah, it's a much lower threshold. By Sefer Torah, Shabbat HaKulam can be considered writing on Shabbos. My whole point from all of this is that it's possible that this brain-computer interface system, it would be allowed to be used on Shabbos, because that's just the thought, right? The thinking is causing the computer to write information. Maybe that wouldn't, might not have this high threshold of being considered a tziva on Shabbos. But again, if somehow this is connected to a pen and maybe somehow, then maybe that somehow can be good for writing a Sefer Torah. So by thinking, I can write a Sefer Torah, but I wouldn't be, and I would still be allowed to use it on Shabbos because of this, we have these different definitions of what is considered a Maisa. There is, though, one point I want to make from all of this. Now, right, we give a whole bunch of examples, prosthetic arms, this variations in blood flow, this brain-computer interface. We have a whole bunch of different examples, and we're analyzing all of them, and all that is great. But it might miss a more fundamental point in all of this, which is, in halacha, it could be that there's that in order to be considered a ma'isa, it has to be biologic, muscular movement. I don't have any sources to prove that, and I would like to be able to prove it. But it makes sense that, you know, in order to be to something to have to do a ma'isa, in order for something to be categorized as a ma'isa, as something of an action that I'm actually doing in halacha, forget, you know, all this fancy stuff. Halacha looks, you know, as a very primitive, for lack of a better word, way of thinking about action. Action is something that I do with my muscle. It's muscular power. That's what's considered action. As soon as I start hooking myself up to all these other machines that are then causing other things to occur, maybe that's not considered a maxa at all. It's something else entirely different. Forget all of our arguments about biological function, arguments about thought. It's just something that's not considered a maxa at all. And true, I do have this mechilta that makes the case that, you know, thinking is going to be also on Shabbos, in which case it's some sort of ma'isa, but I don't think that's, you know, pashut at all. I think that's quite a big chiddush. I think that it makes much more sense to argue that the only way you can have a real ma'isa in halacha is if it's muscular power, muscular action. Now, since I don't really have any sources one way or the other in any of this, I feel totally comfortable saying, reaching whatever conclusion I want, because prove me wrong. So until, other people decide to, people much smarter than myself decide to write things about this, that's the conclusion that I think makes the most sense in regards to all these devices. That's pretty much the end of that part of the shiur. I do want to thank all of you for listening and joining every week. This is the first time I got to present. I was thinking about this series for a while. This is the first time I've given some of the shiur in other contexts, but being able to actually put it together in this format to present it to a highly educated audience was a pleasure. And I appreciate all your input and all your feedback. And hopefully we'll have a chance to do this again in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi. On behalf of the shul, who they're underwrote this whole thing, so we'd like to thank Shari Torah Orthodox Congregation. And I'd like to thank, of course, Rabbi Cohen, who made it happen, and all those who are really recipients of the Divrei Torah. And we hope to see you soon. And everybody be healthy, everybody good, and enjoy this extra month, the extra month of Adar Hashem has given us to enjoy and get prepared also not for Purim, but also Pesach, the juxtaposition of Purim and Pesach, Gula the Gula. So please, God, let this year be the true year of Gula for all of Klal Yisrael. So everybody have a good evening. And I will speak to you tomorrow, Rabbi Cohen, and we'll just bring everything up together, okay?
Okay, actually, sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Does anyone have any questions or?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I don't know if any. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I didn't want any questions first. I didn't really have questions first. Yeah.
I had a sort of a tangent, something that came up at the Jewish Theological Seminary. I went to a symposium that was inconclusive, but it also dealt with cochlear implants. But the question was, what does Jewish law tell us about children born deaf? Should they be implanted? Should they not be implanted? Is there an approach to that area through Jewish law? For a long time, that was very controversial, especially the deaf community, including Jewish deaf community, was opposed to implants. I don't know what their stand is these days, but they said, it's an interference with really their world, which was the world of the deaf. I don't know if you've come across any discussions of that anywhere.
I haven't seen, Rai Shor, have you seen anything like this?
No, not at all. Huh.
So the only thing that comes, sorry.
No, go ahead.
The only thing that comes to mind is there seems to be this concept. I actually do have also some sources for. If you want, I can. We should start email chain here. But there does seem to be this sort of concept. This the Rav spoke about this a lot in Halachic Man. I know I have some sources from. I know Blythe has spoken about this somewhere. I think there are a couple of others which I can't remember off the top of my head. But there is this concept in general. Now, I know this could be very sensitive because the deaf community has their own structure and has a whole community built around this. So I want to be very careful about about their sensitivities. I'm not sure, I don't understand enough to be able to, give a real opinion about that. So I'm going to sort of avoid it. But I'm going to answer a different question, and you can apply it as you see fit. The idea is that these sort of questions come up all the time in regards to can we manipulate DNA? Can we manipulate let's say the whole part of the problem with using PGD, right, with IVF, that you're able to program, basically able to program babies. So, the original technology is used to, or technology now is used to prevent babies from having illnesses. But in theory, I can, if I have the right data and the right information, I should be able to, program what my kids look like. Maybe I can even program how smart they're going to be, assuming that that's all genetic and not, other factors. So the pushback to all these things is always, or also with like stem cell meat, right? Producing meat out of stem cells. The pushback to all of this tends to be, well, God created a world a certain way, and who are you to manipulate in God's world? So these sources, at least, don't seem to think like that. They think that, Hashem gave us the world, and He taught us how to manipulate that world and how to function in that world. And we have the right to go ahead and do that, to go ahead and use our scientific knowledge to make the world a better place, or, however we see fit. This obviously gets a little bit more, problematic, if everyone's trying to have kids with blonde hair and blue eyes, then maybe, it's not necessarily the best thing. But I have a hard time making a halachic argument to prove that point. I would just say, maybe we shouldn't, we should have a little bit of variation. So as far as as giving kids cochlear implants immediately, leaving aside the, as someone who's not really aware, that I don't really understand that community, the deaf community, but as a general principle, as a general idea, if we have if we have a way to actually help people. Now, obviously cochlear implants is going to be a little bit more complicated, right? Because as we mentioned last time, I think you brought it up, right? That with kids, cochlear implants work better for people that were able to hear immediately as opposed to people that are deaf from birth, right? So that can potentially make this more complicated. But assuming that we have a remedy to make you be able to hear, then, you should be able to hear. Why not? Just in terms of, you can do more mitzvahs that way, I guess, if you want to make that argument. Then you're going to ask me, is there a chiv to do it? Am I obligated? So that, this way, let's assume that with a cochlear implant, you can be, let's say, Kriyas Megillah, according to those positions. So then would you make the case that you're obligated to do it, so that this way you can be able to, that sounds a little bit more complicated. I don't know if you can necessarily make the case that you're obligated to do it. But if you do it, you'll have the option to hear Megillah. It sounds like a good thing. But again, very complicated, and I think very nuanced. So it's, especially because, as you mentioned, they do have, their own communities, and it's a culture, and maybe it is better for them. I don't know. So I'm leaving that aside.
That's one issue. The other issue that used to come up a lot when I was still at the university, particularly when I had kids visiting, how do we justify just doing research with animals? And to me, I always argued that there's a clear, at least from the Jewish perspective, as I understand it, there's a clear distinction between animals and humans, us and the other animal kingdom. So, we have an obligation towards them, but they're not our equals. I mean, that argument was a very strong one being made, maybe still is by animal rights activists, they are our equals. And I viewed that as a real violation of my belief structure. Maybe it was a violation of my ability to make a living. I don't know. But I don't know if that ever comes up in Orthodox circles. That somehow, you know, the argument that was always given is if there's people in a boat, a man in a boat with a dog, it's a mean guy and a beautiful dog that you love, and the boat's about to, the boat turns over and you can only rescue one, what is your obligation? Who do you rescue? To me, there's no question you have to rescue the guy, even if he's a bad guy. But kids didn't believe that. That's not what they were learning. I don't know. This was a while, you know, a decade ago, but
I think the last like 2 years
it's a very big, it's a side issue, but
right, Bob, I come up with the Epstein School. Can I teach at the Epstein School? I do teach a moral for 7th and 8th graders, and that comes up, and especially with the recent xenotransplantation, just recently, I think of a heart. And a lot of the kids were mortified that they'd kill an animal, but others came to defenses that you cannot compare the life of a human being to that of an animal. And then I do the lifeboat situation, and that is every year is a different. I can have a couple of years in a row where kids say, you know, you save the dog. And then I have years in a row, save the dog, but feed the dog to the people on the boat to save them. But others say there's no question that a human takes precedence. So I don't think it's across the board. I think after teaching at Epstein School for 30 years, I've seen some years yes, some years no. And this year, my group is very, very, no, last year, they were very, very pro saving a life at any cost. Even at the life of an animal. And I told them, you can't compare the life of an animal to that of a human being.
Yeah, and I would say, suppose we had a room full of hungry lions and cows. Are you going to explain to the lions not to eat the cows? I mean, it's different. We're different. But anyway, that was always out there. But I'm not the issue you're immediately addressing. But it's interesting that you're... I hope you're going to publish this stuff eventually in between your practice. And what school? So what school are you in now?
Where are you? We